the person in is Xiaofeng Ren from Utah University, and he was in he's in the program actually. He was listed in the program. So people interested in copolymers should get. Yeah. Copolymer. Is that correct? Okay, so now I would like to state the result, I would say the positive result, which in some sense closed the story started by the negative result of Alexander Schneeleman. So I remind you that I will focus on what I call the Schneeleman's data that is to say maps on the unit cube that are actually maps on the unique square lift to the third dimension in this way, and here H belongs to the set of the group of area preserving maps of the square. And actually I will make most of the statement in a larger framework in H, or more generally. H is in S of 0, 1 square, and I remind you that these maps are the maps from the square into itself that are measure-preserving in the sense of measure theory, that is to say the integral of phi of H of x dx on the square is the same as the integral of phi, the Lebesgue integral of phi. Okay.
Capital H.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so I will concentrate on this case, because the analysis is simpler, but some of the results are still true when H is a general map in S of 0, 1 cube, in the cube. Okay, so the first, so we have the following results. So most of these results are contained in the paper published in the Communication in Pure and Applied Maths in 1999, published 2 years ago. And so the first result that we already see, that for all H in S of 0, 1 square, there are optimal solution CM to the generalized shortest path problem, so maybe I should put again what is this generalized shortest path problem. So we are looking for a pair of measure. So C is a non-negative, a pair of real and vector-valued measure on the time interval 0, 1. X belongs to the cube. And A is the label of the particle. So of particle, and you can consider, for instance, for simplicity, that this is the same as the initial position of the particle. But that's not necessary. And so they should satisfy the continuity equation. So C can be considered as a concentration field and M as the momentum field for each particle. So it's like, I would say this is similar to the description of a multiphasic flow. A, you can consider that A is like a phase label, so each phase moves and satisfies the continuity equation. We have the property that the marginal, I mean, when we integrate the measure C with respect to A, we should end up with the Lebesgue measure, that we can write that this way if you wish. And the quantity to minimize is it's the infimum of the integral of m squared divided by 2c. And we saw a precise definition of this object yesterday. And this should be defined, this quantity that I denote by k of c and m, can be defined by Legendre duality. So redefined by Legendre duality. And this makes the problem quite easy, because this is a convex functional and the constraints are linear. And the set of measure, you can use the weak compactness of measure, and the only thing to check, as I told you, that the only thing to check is that there exists at least for each data a pair CM such that K is finite. I should have.
What's the function spaces?
So you. Well, you look for C and M as a measure that is in the dual of the continuous function of T, X, and A. And everything is compact. Okay. So, yeah, you could put that. And so the only, because this is not clearly finite, of course, and so, but I forgot to put the boundary condition, so we wish this to be the Dirac measure located at the initial position of the particle, so I will use this notation I of A if I take the space of label different from the initial position. So this is the initial position of each particle, and the final data at time 1 is delta of x minus h of I of A. And nice. Okay.
Can you please lower the overhead?
Ah, okay, sorry. Yeah, I remember, I forgot that. Yeah. Look. And it's here. Thank you. Okay. And so, this is and the infimum of KCM in this class is bounded by 3. This is this is the first statement. The second statement, which is more interesting because it makes the link with the classical minimization problem, is that I should give a name to this number. So this is a function of capital H. So let me call it J, capital J of H, right? There you can, a priori, this function C, this measure C and M depends on three coordinates, because we are on the cube. The data is two-dimensional, but we are really looking for a generalized flow on the unit cube. But the generalized solution are so that actually the optimal solution are necessary depends only on two space variables.
Excuse me. Yeah, for the existence of minimizer, you need to restrict all your Schwingerman data?
No, not at all. Yeah, yeah. But there is one result soon, which will Yeah, that's right. So the next point is that. So now I use that there are final mass data. Yeah, that's right. So this C and M actually depends only on X1 and X2. They are not X3 dependent. And the third coordinate of M and M3 is zero. So which means that for the generalized flow, there is no motion. It's really a two-dimensional solution in some sense. You know, there are no motion, no vertical motion. The third step is that you can find for all epsilon, there will be a classical incompressible flow. So this is a map from 0,1 to the unit cube into itself. Right? Okay. Such that. So that they converge in some appropriate sense to C and M in the following way. So first of all, they will match approximately. So this is, I should have written, it would be better to write that as a time-dependent map in the group of diffeomorphism of the cube. So this is a classical incompressible flow, such that the action of G epsilon, so first of all, G epsilon at time zero will be the identity map in the cube. G epsilon at time one will approximately match the final data little h in the L2 sense on the cube. The action of G epsilon, which is one half the integral in time of the kinetic energy, will almost reach J of H. And in addition, we can choose G epsilon in such a way that C can be seen as a weak limit of G epsilon, in the sense that, and if we do the embedding of G epsilon in the generalized flow, that is, if we compute this quantity, this will be weakly convergent as epsilon tends to zero, so that it's a double statement, so I should do A and B. As epsilon goes to zero, this will converge weakly to, so I should put an I of A here, because this is the initial position of the particle, to CTXA weakly, and DT G epsilon TI of A will converge weakly, or time delta will converge to M TXNA weakly. So, which means that this generalized solution are very close. In particular, all the solutions that I showed to you numerically that looks very weird, actually, they can be approximated by a classical incompressible flow in this way. So I will make a comment on this result later.
So convergence is weak star and bottom measures.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And in addition, we have something even better than that, that G epsilon is almost a solution to the Euler equation, to the classical Euler equation, in the sense that if we look at the if V epsilon of TNX is defined as usual by V epsilon of T G epsilon of TX is equal to DT of G epsilon and TNX as usual, then the acceleration of the field will converge to some distribution minus grad p, depending on t and x, as epsilon tends to zero. So this is in the distributional sense. So the acceleration field, so I need more room. Where this grad p, and so this is where grad p is the dual unknown of the generalized shortest path problem, depends only on x1 and x2, on t x1 and x2, so it doesn't depend on the vertical coordinates. And is uniquely defined by capital H. Okay, so this generalized infimum can be approximately achieved by a sequence of approximate solution of the Euler equation. And in addition, the pressure field, all the acceleration field of this approximate solution converge to the same field. So in some sense, this is maybe the main part of the theorem, that you have an acceleration field which is unique, it depends only on the data. And this acceleration, this gradient of pressure, in some sense, attracts all the classical flow that try to match the generalized infimum. So,
before you get to the pressure, can I ask something?
Yeah, sure, of course.
So the somehow by, I'm bothered a bit by the target condition on the G epsilon. Can you by sort of matching two flows and putting in a little piece that connects sort of exactly?
Yeah, but
after t equals
0.999. Yeah, that's an excellent question, and this is one of the main remarks that I'm going to do, because, for instance, at this point, this doesn't show that the generalized problem and the classical problem have the same infimum. Yeah, that's a very extremely excellent remark. It's uniquely defined by H. Yeah. Okay, and in addition, now there is a fourth result is that we can write an equation for T and M. That is, we can write a self-consistent set of equations driving T and M, because so far we have only this PDE and this constraint. But in addition, all optimal solutions, CM, have the following properties. The first of all, M is absolutely continuous with respect to C and can be written as we expected, actually. This is almost obvious. That can be factorized as a C times V, where V belongs to the space L2 of all variables according to the measure C. And now we can write the PDE which corresponds to a momentum equation for each particle, if you wish. So this looks like a conventional conservation of momentum equation. So we have dTCV, plus the divergence in X of C V tensor V. So by this I mean just in coordinate, this is the DJ of C V I V J, if you wish. And this is balanced by the pressure field. But here we have to be very careful because this is like in multiphasic flow. This cannot be written in conservation form. So we have the factor C here. And of course, I have now to be extremely careful about this term.
Sorry, again.
Yeah.
The V, is that now a definition, the first thing, or do you get the V from statement 3 by taking the limit of the V epsilon?
No, it's actually it's a much more elementary reason. It's because this number is finite.
Okay, so it's just a definition of the V then.
Yeah, that's right. Because if you look carefully at the definition of K I gave yesterday by Lejeune transform, actually, if this number is finite, it implies that M is absolutely continuous with respect to C and the density is L2. This is what you get. So now there is something. So everything looks nice because C, it's M is a measure, so DTCM doesn't make any problem. V is in L2 with respect to C, that then therefore you can define that. But this seems to be completely absurd, and so I have to explain what it is, where grad P can be shown to be a measure, to be a Radon measure. I mean a measure, it's a locally bounded measure. In the interior of the space-time domain, that is in 0,1 cross 0,1 squared. P depends only on X2. So this is still not satisfactory because grad P is a measure and C is a measure, so this pairing has completely doesn't mean anything. And the pairing C dot grad P can be properly defined. So I will put that in outside of the theorem because it's too long otherwise, properly defined. So I have to make a set of remarks now. I think this is the whole result that we can get at the moment. So maybe I could add also that the kinetic, maybe a fifth statement, that you can show that actually the integral of V square of Tx and A square integrated with respect to dx and dA is actually a function of time a priori, but this is constant. So this double integral as a function of time is constant. And this is a natural definition of the kinetic energy in the generalized framework. So it means that the generalized solutions are energy preserving in time, which means that generalized solutions are energy preserving. Oh, this is because there are minimizers. And actually, this is not a difficult statement. It is actually when you prove the conservation, I mean, this is a Noether theorem. So it's because this functional doesn't depend on time. And so if you use variations in time, the very, very stupidly, then you get this for free almost. So this is
essentially comes from using inner variations.
That's right. Everything is, and also I will comment this result. This is also a kind of regularity result obtained by variation also. The fact that grad P is properly defined. So now I would like to make a comment and maybe to give some flavor of some proofs.
I still don't understand the statement 4. How does grad P be defined? Is it defined by equation B? So that would mean you have to take C times V plus this gradient and blah, 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 then divide by C, then prove that what you have is a gradient of something?
No. Well, maybe it's better to try to give the remarks, and maybe at some point, if I forget to talk about that, because otherwise I could miss some points. So, but of course this is. So let me do a lot of remarks now to make a lot of comments on this result. So the first one, and as you pointed out, that the point three does not imply that the classical infimum that when H is smooth, that is a classical area preserving diffeomorphism of the square. It doesn't imply that when H is in G, the classical infimum is equal to the generalized infimum. Because in this statement, in the point 3, we show that there are classical flow very close to the generalized solution, but as was pointed out, they don't exactly match the final map, and this is a weak. This can be seen both ways as a bad result and an interesting result. It is clearly a bad result in the sense that we don't exactly match, and so we cannot claim that at this time. The good thing, I believe, is that this allows you to consider generalized final data. That is. Area preserving map in the measure theoretical sense. For instance, all the numerical computation I've done fits in this framework. So if you have the hat function, the one-dimensional hat function as a target, this can be embedded in this theorem. That is, the numerical picture you saw can be treated by this result. So in some sense, it's a good result because you can describe more phenomenon, but it's a weakness because you don't prove that rigorously when H is in G01, because it is not obvious that if you try to, when H is a smooth diffeomorphism, it is not obvious that you can, well, of course you can rescale G epsilon to 0.9999, as you said, but you have to do the final step. to match this, and this might be very hard actually, and very energy consuming. So then this result, however, here we can use a more refined result than this one. However, this is true according to another result of Neumann. Density theorem published in 94 in the Journal of Geometry and Applied Functional Analysis, where there is 1944, which says that so let me quote this result independently of the theorem, which says the following, that on the unit cube, generalized flows. So actually he did a proof He did the proof for the earlier definition of generalized flows I gave in around 1988, which is not exactly the one I'm using here. But I guess there is no problem to modify the proof in that case. On the generalized flow can be approximated reaching at time one a smooth diffeomorphism, some H in G01 cube. So here, this is not to answer your question. It's not a Serre-Schneerman's data. Genetic flow can be approximated, can be weakly approximated by classical flows. G epsilon, and these flows match really the final H. So here there is no gap. It's exactly H, and in addition, and the important thing is there is no loss of energy with the action of the energy with no gap in the energy. That is, I mean that the time integral of the kinetic energy of G epsilon converge to the equivalent things for the generalized flow. Okay, so if you follow this theorem, then the classical infimum is equal to the generalized infimum because you can do this final step that you mentioned. Okay, so actually I didn't wish to use this result in my theorem, because the proof is quite hard to understand, actually. And I was not completely sure, I mean, of the... It doesn't mean at all. I was too lazy to really understand, because the construction is some kind of a fractal... Very interesting, actually. It's a very interesting result. And it's a multiscale construction, because Neumann is really an expert in multiscale constructions. And he managed to do that. And the difficult there are two a very interesting feature in this theorem is, first of all, you don't use an extra dimension, so it's internal in the dimension 3. You cannot do that in dimension 2. So in dimension 3, you can manage to approximate a generalized flow without adding an extra dimension, and in addition, you can reach the final map. Okay, so it's a quite strong result. The result I use in the paper is a much more elementary version of that, a much weaker version of that, really much weaker, but it's very easy to understand. The construction is almost straightforward. So in the CPM paper, a much weaker version of this result is used and proved. Is used. First of all, you give up the exact final, where we have only G epsilon of 1 minus H in L2 is small, less than epsilon, for instance. And we use the third dimension. So you remember that the generalized flow for Schneerman's data are really two-dimensional, and so we use the third coordinates to do the lifting. Okay, and we use the third the vertical coordinate, which is, of course, much easier to construct G epsilon. And actually, this is it is a little bit difficult to explain in few words, but the construction is very similar to the construction. It's more or less the inverse reasoning of what the people do for multiphasic flow. I mean, usually when people are writing equation for multiphasic flow, they write in one dimension. So they are thinking about, let's say, a three-dimensional or two-dimensional extension, like a thin tube or a thin layer. And so they assume that the phases are sharing the space. So for instance, you have two phases, and one is on top of the other one, and there is a classical way of getting multiphasic equation by averaging in the vertical coordinates. So in some sense, the construction is exactly the reverse one. That is, when you have the CTXA, which are in some sense the concentration for each value of A, you have the concentration in the on the square. You lift the square to a cube by adding an additional dimension, and you then the concentration function are able to give you more or less the elevation of each phase in the cube, and then from VTXA and CTXA, you can rebuild a classical divergence free vector field, which more or less, which is very close. If you consider, of course, that this cube is very thin, or if you prefer that you have by periodicity do some kind of a lamination of the cube. And the last point, of course, if you do that in this straightforward way, you don't match exactly the final condition. So this is why you have this gap here. But this is a straightforward and much more PDE style proof of the density result. But it would be interesting that some people look more carefully at this GAFA paper in order to understand really more deeply the construction of neural maps, which is not so obvious because the proofs are very sketchy and very, in the geometric style. You know? So it is not so easy to match carefully. Okay, so in some sense, and of course, if this theorem, if you accept this result, then the point three can be of course improved a lot, because for instance you don't need to have Schneeleman's data. You can take full three-dimensional data in the group of diffeomorphism of the cube, and then there is no you exactly reach the final map, and therefore there is no gap, and this showed that there is no gap. But in some sense I don't believe so much. I mean, this is a philosophical statement that for me the conclusion of the story is that in the 3D case the group of diffeomorphism is not so relevant, that I think the much more reasonable object is this set of volume preserving map in the measure theoretic sense. And here, I mean, this gives a satisfactory result. I mean, if I consider that the right data are the measure preserving maps, I don't care about this problem in some sense, but I care about the fact that the generalized solution can be approximated by classical flows. Okay, I think of course this is cheaper, but I think this is relevant.
As far as resistance is concerned, then you don't have to stay in the cube. Any three-dimensional domain would do the same. No?
Yeah, well, I mean, one has to be careful about the lifting. But if you have a cylinder, for instance, yeah. Yeah, if you have a cylinder, I mean, you have the third coordinate is, yeah, it's a product of the, this is what you mean, the unit interval by, yeah. I don't see a big modification to do. Okay? The only thing, you have to be careful about the topology. For instance, the construction on the torus, on the 2D torus, this is dangerous, actually. Because the generalized solution, in some sense, can ignore the topology. Because when you do, yeah. That's an interesting point also. If you work on the torus, one has to be very careful. Actually, I started doing that because the torus is very nice. You have no boundary for the regularity issues. It's much better. So, I mean, you just use translation method. It's very simple. But it's much simpler, I would say. But the problem is if a particle has to go from one point on the torus to another point, in the classical way, there is no choice. I mean, you have to count the number of, I don't remember the name for that, but if you have to decide how many turns you have made. Yeah. Okay, how many periods you made. Okay? And of course, if you deal with generalized flow, you have the possibility of splitting the particle, the path of the particle in many paths. So these paths can have different periods. So you can reach any numbers, actually, real numbers, by this convex combination. So it means that the problem on the torus or on a set with a non-trivial topology has to be worked out in a different way. So this is correct for, I would say, if you have a convex set or presumably a simply connected set in the 2D case, and you take the cylinder. The construction will be the same. But if you have a non-trivial topology, because if you have an obstacle, it's the same. If you have a hole, if you have an annulus, for instance, with a generalized flow, you can decide to go to follow, to go clockwise or counterclockwise, and so it's not completely, it's not really the same. So one has to be very careful when the topology is not trivial. Okay. So now other important remarks. So tell me if I, yeah, what is grad P? What is, I would like to focus on that now, because this is the part where there is really some analysis to do. Okay, because the density construction is not so complicated. So now the comments about grad P. Grad P and the regularities issues. Okay. So the beginning is very simple, because we have the this problem of minimizing KCM with linear constraints. Actually, it can be seen as a kind of, if you have attended the talk by Robert McCann, this is very similar type of problems. Actually, this problem can be considered in this Monge-Kantorovich setting. So it's a more sophisticated version of the Monge-Kantorovich setting, because it means that you wish to do the mass transportation of a continuum of probability measure with a global constraint on them. That all these probability measures should add up to the unit, to the Lebesgue measure. So it's a constraint mass transportation problem. But the beginning is very similar. So you have a duality can be written as an inf soup. An inf soup where the supremum involves two types of Lagrange multiplier. There is, if you remember the constraint, there is the constraint of the continuity equation, which must be satisfied for all particles. So it's so the Lagrange multiplier, the corresponding Lagrange multiplier will be a function phi depending on Tx and A. For the continuity equation. And actually, it turns out that this is, I will say that in a moment. And the second Lagrange multiplier is a function of TNX, which deal with this global constraint on the density, that when we add up these probability measures, we should find one. And so this is a generalized incompressibility constraint. So it's natural to call that P. This will be the pressure field. Okay. So the problem is that as usual, you can reverse the soup and the inf. So there is no problem. But actually, here the supremum, it is absolutely not clear that the supremum is achieved. Actually, because actually the generalized problem is really the dual problem. And the primal problem involves phi and p, and this problem a priori has no solution. The infimum is not reached. The functional space is the space of continuous phi and p, and there is no reason for the supremum to be achieved. So you have really to work out by using optimal solution. Okay, so when you do the duality, the formal duality equation, actually what you find that for all epsilon there is phi epsilon and pi p epsilon that you can choose smooth, such that you get the two equations. You get that dt phi a kind of Hamilton Jacobi equation for epsilon. I mean, you get this kind of inequality, so you can take them smooth. So that's no problem. So you have this inequality for all A. And this is almost zero in the sense that C time. So here, C is an optimal solution. Because for the minimizing in CNM is easy, so you get easily a minimizer on this side. And for every minimizer CNM, you can find this kind of function. And here we will get the integral of that is almost zero. So this is integrated in C. This is less than epsilon. So which means that you have almost the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, but it's weighted by C. And that's not very good news, because C can be highly concentrated. For instance, if you have a classical solution, C will be a delta. So this is not easy to handle with. But we get some kind of, in addition, from the variational principle, we get an approximate smoothness of phi epsilon. I think it's, if you remember the talk yesterday about the elasticity, I think this is a similar phenomenon. That is, you see some approximate smoothness for the approximate minimizer, but it's only in the limit that you get really the nice thing. So phi epsilon is nearly in something which doesn't make a lot of sense, the Sobolev space H1 with respect to C, which is meaningless, right? So this is formally, you would have in the limit something like C dt phi square plus the x derivative of phi. No, sorry, this is the gradient. So it's much better than that. It's the gradient of phi, which is approximately in H1. So these are the second derivative of phi square, finite, locally finite. So in any locally. And of course, I should put some quotes, because this would be for the formal limit that you cannot show that it exists really. But you get finite difference approximation of this formula, uniformly bounded in epsilon, something like that. So, which is really a feature coming from the minimization principle. There is no reason to expect that if you would deal with an evolution equation, for instance. This is really a regularity already, due to minimization. Well, there is a little hope to make that rigorous, because there is this theory due to, I think, Bouchité and Butazzo about Sobolev space with weighted by measure, but I doubt that this can be used here, because you need we essentially know nothing about C. The problem in this minimization problem, the big difficulty is that we don't know nothing about C, whether it is concentrated or not. So, of course, all the results would be much easier if you put the assumption, for instance, that C is bounded away from zero, for instance, which is really a heavy cheating. Then most of the work can be done in a quite easy way. Okay? So now let me do a formal reasoning, and then you have to work out with the finite difference approximation of that, so it's quite messy. But assume that this is true, and then we can pass to the limit. So assume that we can write, which I can't do, actually, this. Oh, I forgot the square here, sorry. There is a square. Square plus p is equal to zero. So now let's do the formal reasoning. So we have this equation. So let's differentiate that in x. So we get dt of grad phi plus, and let me use the notation. Actually, formally, the v should be grad phi of t and x, but this I cannot prove. That is, there is an extra result which can be expected and I was not able to prove, is that each of these velocity field v is actually a potential flow. So this generalized incompressible flow is a mixture of potential flows, which is a little bit weird, but this is, I don't know how to prove it because of this problem of this weighted equality. So I don't know if there is a possibility to define rigorously phi. This would be an interesting improvement of the result. Okay, so I have that. So if I differentiate that, of course I will get something using the symmetry of the second derivative of phi, I will get something like that. Okay? Which is the classical fluid mechanics equation telling you that each acceleration field is balanced by the pressure field. Now, let's multiply this equation by C, right? Formally still, and put some absolute value. So we have C grad P is equal to C, and we integrate dTV plus V grad V, right? But here, remember that grad P depends only on T and X. Grad P depends only on T and X. So we can integrate C with respect to A, and this is 1. So actually, this is just the integral of grad P. And you can see that this quantity is easily bounded once you have that, at least locally. So this means that grad P is a locally bounded measure. And I insist that this is a regularity result. Although it looks very weak, I mean, in the classical Euler equation, if you don't assume any smoothness of the solution, just the finiteness of the kinetic energy, you barely get that P is in L1 or in measure, because you have the Laplace of P in the classical Euler equation is balanced by the second derivative of the V tensor V. So if V tensor V, for weak, assume that you have weak solution, V tensor V will be an L1, and we know that actually the regularity theory for the elliptic regularity doesn't work in L1, but let's cheat a little bit. V tensor V is in L1, so P is in L1, barely in L1. But here we have one more derivative in control, under control. And so now the last thing to say is how to...
You haven't said about the uniqueness, though.
Oh, yeah. So thank you. The uniqueness is actually an output of the fact that, for instance, if you average this equation with respect to A, you get something like C dt... what you are able to show is this... If I integrate that in A, integrated in A, you can get rid of the C. So, for instance, the equation I wrote was hard to define because of the multiplication between C and grad P. But when you integrate the variable A, the problem is disappear. And actually, this is in the different step of the proof. This is at some point you get this equation, the average equation in A, and this equation tell you that this is true for all minimizers C and V. So anytime in the reasoning, for all P, you have this relation with all minimizer. So this is standard linear programming. So you have a relationship which is true for whatever minimizer you take, okay? And therefore, grad P must be unique, because you can choose there is only one possibility for grad P.
Okay, but that just shows.
Sorry to interrupt.
The time is.
So
we are going to. Okay.
I'm sorry about
that. Yeah, sure.
But yeah. You can finish. You can give it.
Okay.
I thought that this was going to.
So we already started the questions. And.
Maybe you should finish the.
In one word, but I was almost finished. So the uniqueness comes from this. And now the only thing I would like to tell one word is how you can pair grad P and C. C and grad P. So you have a product like this. And so at the first glance, of course, if we don't know that grad P is a measure, it's a disaster. We can do anything. So now this is a measure. This is a measure. That bad. Very bad. But we see that this measure doesn't depend on A. So what really matters is when we integrate this, we take some moment in A, right? But since the integral of C with respect to A is 1, this will be always an L-infinity function in T and X for the Lebesgue measure. Okay, so the problem now is more reasonable. It's a product of an L-infinity function by a measure. So this is like the famous H delta problem, Heaviside against delta, that you find, for instance, in the Burgers equation, in the Volpert theory of Burgers equation, or in the paper of Yu-Shi Chang and Maida about vortex electron sheets problems. And actually, because of the minimization problem, you can see that these things, that let's call that C sub phi of TnX, this measure can be extended by local average at the point where grad p is singular. So if you remember maybe the Volpert's theory for Burgers equation, this is similar. That is, when you have a shock, you can manage to define the right extension of the solution to be the midpoint. So here this is something similar, that is, if you take some local average of C phi around the point where grad p is singular, actually this will correspond to the limit of the approximate equation you get from the variational principle. Okay, thank you very much. And since I've never thanked the organizer, this is a good time for doing it.
Use a couple of minutes for.
Well, I never talked about references, so there are. So you can download some preprints on my web page. So now we don't need to give a web address, because we have Google, for instance. So you use Google Brenier, and then you will find that in the first will be the homepage. Okay. And so there will be a list of preprints, including the CPM paper is listed. And inside this paper, actually, you have quite a lot of references, I would say.
Yeah. So I wish to thank again Yannis.